Dear Lord God, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to come together and learn a little bit more of the wonders that you have created that seem to fly under the radar sometimes, but at this conference they're pretty well lit up. But Lord, give us wisdom and understanding and to appreciate everything that you do. Amen. My name is Dan Hutton, and I take care of a ranch, and I have a garden, and so I know a little bit about gardening. Last year I went to the agriculture conference they had in Tennessee. Same thing, but it was in Tennessee. And I met several people, and I learned different things that I didn't know much about. And this is my partner in crime, Tom. We're sort of tag teaming. I helped him with the Mrs. White method of planting trees, and he's actually better at this presentation than I am, but we're trading off. Anyway, went to this conference. Well, first off, when you think of food and you think, what can I do to make this food taste better? What do you add to food to make it taste better?
Ketchup.
Good. Ketchup's good. What else? Salt. Okay. What else? Herbs. Okay. Good. Oil. Okay. What else? Sugar. Okay. So, we're going to talk about one of those things that what our bodies like is salt. We like salt. And we're going to talk about how that affects the plants. And the other thing that I learned at the conference last year, and I'm just going to barely touch on this, that sugar, which we like, we love, is also good for plants. And when you make, okay, do people know what molasses is? What is molasses? Okay? What is it? What about the sugar cane? Is molasses. Okay? This is correct. When they make sugar, they take the beets or the cane or the sorghum or whatever they're using, and they beat it up. And they take off the liquid, and then they refine it, and they refine it, and they end up with white powder or white crystals. And that's not meth. I mean, coke. But they end up with white powder that we eat as white sugar. And everything else that they refined off of the liquid, it becomes molasses. They take all the good out, and they leave, and we get all the bad, and the good is in the molasses. It's high in all the nutrients, or most all the nutrients, and it's very good. And when you put it on the soil, when you're adding you have microlife, you take a soil sample, and you determine, I need to add this element, and I need to add this element, and I need to add this element. And then you add microlife, Z-Hume or humate or various kinds of humic acids and other forms of microlife, and you add either sugar or molasses. That the molasses is food for the microlife, and the microlife then eats on those nutrients and makes the nutrients available to the plant. So if you feed the microlife, it feeds the plant. And it's amazing what sugar will do. Now, that's just a little introduction to the subject. there's a lot more to it, and we're not going to go, unless you have questions, we'll touch on it more. Okay, the other thing is salt. In the 1930s, there was a fellow by the name of Maynard Murray. And Maynard Murray was a physician in Boston. And he enjoyed going down to the docks, and he would watch when the ships would come in and they'd unload their cargo, and he'd see the creatures that they'd bring in. And he was noticing that they didn't have the diseases that he was seeing in the hospital. He would see all the different kinds of diseases people get, and he would look at the sea creatures, and they weren't getting those diseases. And he was putting things together in his mind that something's going on here. I want to learn more. So since he was a physician, he hired himself on as a ship's mortician. And he went all around the world on a 7-8 months, and they'd bring creatures in, and he'd cut them open and look for diseases, and he didn't find any. And one of the things that they did, which totally incomprehensible in our time, but it was common back then, is that they'd catch whales. And whales. And so they brought on a whale and a baby, a mother and baby. And he cut them open and went looking for any problems or diseases or anything. And the baby was about a year and a half old, and the mother, it was guessed, was approximately 80 years old. And he was comparing the flesh of the baby and the mother, and there was no difference. There was no sign of aging in the mother's tissues. It was like you don't get older, you just get bigger. And he was pretty impressed with that. So they did, they tested the seawater, and they found out that there are more than 90 different elements in the water, and they are in a precise balance. And if you go, what I understand, I'm not a chemist, so I don't know all the chemical interactions of the different things. I know what I've been taught, and I know what I've experienced, but I'm not a chemist. But they say that there's a precise balance, and you go anywhere in the world, and you find the same balance in the ocean, not in bays, not in river inlets or outlets, but in the big ocean, you find pretty much the same balance wherever. And as you know, all over the world, you have things high, and the water takes it and takes it and takes it, and everything eventually ends up in the ocean. The elements, whatever was on top of the mountain, ends up in the ocean. And then when it's in the ocean goes swish, swash, swish, swash, swish, swash, all day long and all night long. And the things that God created, a balance for the ocean, which is very close to the same balance that we have in our tissues. In our fluids, our blood and the other body tissue fluids have just about the same balance as the ocean water. And that is also just about the same balance as the plant sap. And so if you take the elements from the ocean, there's a point, and this is important. If you go and drink ocean water, you will not do well. But if you dilute it 10 to 1, half gallon to 5 gallons, well, that's a lot of water, but that is the same ratio that is in our body. Is that when it's diluted approximately 10 to 1. Am I on course? On course? So, Lynn tells a story. Okay, we've got The water is good for us. Zen tells a story that he had a peach tree. And Tom tells a very similar story. And he put, in this peach tree had peach leaf curl. Does everybody know what peach leaf curl is or does? No? Okay, you were going to, okay, explain. And what does it do? It will kill a tree if left untreated. And it, in a severe case, it will kill the tree. So Lynn took 1 ounce of sea minerals, sea salt. Sea minerals, sea salt, sea solids, those are interchangeable terms. And he dissolved that in hot water, warm water, and then he sloshed it all over the tree. And then he did that 2 more times over a period of time. So after 3 times, all the curly leaf fell off the tree and new leaves came on and it grew really well. And then when the tree was ready to produce fruit, the fruit was spectacular. It was very, very tasty. And he thought, wow, there must be a connection here. The next spring, there was no peach leaf curl. So he didn't add any more salt to the trees. And after the when the peaches were ready to harvest, they weren't as tasty as they'd been the year before. They were average peaches. And so he concluded that there was a direct connection between the flavor of the fruit and the salt, the sea salt, and all the micronutrients that's in them. So I was working with him this year. I met him last year. I flew all the way to Tennessee from California, and I met somebody who lived an hour and a half from me. I became good friends with him. And so back in California, we communicate all the time. And so I call him and I said, I have a problem with fire blight. Do you know what fire blight is on peaches, on apples and pears? What is fire blight? That's correct. It looks like a blowtorch was gone up the arc, down the tree, and the leaves stay there and they're black, and it'll take off this limb and that limb, and then it's gone. And you are correct. And it's a nasty disease, and they say when you have it, it works from the top down. They say go under and cut it out and take that and burn it so that you don't have it around. Well, when you do it, when you take your lopper, your pruners, and you take off each branch or each stem, whatever you're cutting, then you dip it in a sanitizing thing. I use bleach water, chlorine water, and I dip it, and then the next cut, and then dip it, and then the next cut. It's quite tedious, especially if you're on a ladder. And I wasn't having any success with this fire blight, and so I asked Len, I said, should I use the sea salt? And he said, yes, but fire blight is tougher than peach leaf curl. Said, you're going to need to use more, double the rate. And so I did, and I have a little jar, the hose end sprayer, and you hook it up the hose and you spray it wherever, and you put in a solution of whatever you have. And in this case, it was brine, sea salt water, and I sprayed that over the tree and it up and over, and I did a pretty thorough job, and there was a number of trees, and I did it every 2 weeks, 4 times. So I did it 4 times and every 2 weeks, and at the end, it still had fire blight. And I was saying, this isn't working. I'm not so happy with this. I was disappointed. And And then I started, the tree didn't die. They were just had the fire blight, and they still had fruit. And the first tree to come off was an apple. And the last several times, the last time I got apples off the tree, they were pretty tasteless. And they made a really crummy applesauce, and they stayed in the cupboard a long time because I didn't want to eat them. So I tasted it, and I was saying, wow, this is pretty tasty. So I learned about a refractometer last year. And a refractometer is this little device. It's like a binoculars with a prism on it. And so I took the juice from the apple, put it on here, and I looked at it. And the apple that I had the year before were the last one that the apples weren't hardly worth eating. This time, well, an apple at, according to Tom's paper here, apples are poor at 6, average at 10, 14 is good, and 18 is excellent. And this apple tree that had had these crummy apples before, instead of being 18 at excellent, it was 20. And the only thing different was the sea salt. I hadn't done anything else to these plants. And I wanted to bring something, so I brought some dried apples. If you want to pass them around and try them, these are off of that tree. And just be warned, to keep them from turning brown, I put a little bit of lemon on them. So you will taste the lemon. But I think they turned out pretty good. And so then the next tree to come off was a pear that I treated for this fire blight. And see if we can find that on here. Pears are considered excellent at 14. And mine was 20. And I shared them with the lady there at the ranch. And she said, these are decadent. These are wonderful. And I was of the same opinion. So then the third tree was another apple tree. And this apple tree was old when I went to the ranch 25 years ago. And I had tried to revive it and tried to get it to produce well, and it was like one of those trees that you never know why they planted it, because it wasn't, you couldn't make it into anything good. The juice was poor. The applesauce was not hardly edible. It did make good dried apples, and so that's why I kept it, because it made good dried apples if you could keep the worms out of it. Well, this year, instead of being 18, it was 22. And it made fantastic juice, where in the past the juice had never been even drinkable. So I was getting I thought this is pretty neat. Well, this past year in working with Lynn, he has a total program that he works with through International Ag Labs. And I had followed this program, and my soil when I started was out of balance. And he said, this first year, it's not... You're going to, with following this program, you're going to get pretty good yields. It's going to be better, but it's not going to be perfect because your soil is still, was so far out of balance, it's not going to be balanced all the way this first year. But you're going to get good yield, but your Brix level is not going to be that wonderful. And Brix B-R-I-X is the numbers that they it's what they use to measure what this refractometer measures are bricks. And it's the measurement of sugar and minerals in the sap. And so the higher the and every all the different, according to this chart, different plants have different levels, different things are excellent and different things are poor across the whole spectrum. Some things are sweeter foods than others. Watermelons, well, grapes are very sweet, and most of the greens are not very sweet. And it ranges. Everything is different. So you have to individually check everything. Well, I was getting through the season this summer, and I was quite pleased with how things were going. And so I called up Len and I told him, "You told me that I was going to get good yields, but I wasn't going to necessarily get high Brix levels." And I said, "These are the Brix levels that I'm getting. I can't wait to see what I'm getting in the future." And he kind of chuckled. And a couple weeks later, he called up and said, Friday afternoon, "I'm doing a garden presentation in this little tiny town in the Central Valley called Raymond. Arlene, do you know where Raymond is?" I figured you would. And so he said, "Can you bring some of your produce up to my garden demonstration?" And I said, "Okay." And so I drove up Sunday morning, and on the way, I picked up my professor from college. I studied agriculture at La Sierra, and one of my professors' name was George Bergdorf. And he's now 90 years old and retired and lives on the way to where I was going. So I picked up he and his wife. And they had some tomatoes, and it was the very, very, very end of the season for them. And one was this little greenish orange, sort of ripe. And then there was a cherry tomato, and there was a few cherry tomatoes. And so I said, Can I take some of these? And so they said, "Sure." So I took them, the tomatoes and the Bergdorf, the Bergdorfs, and up to this presentation. And Lynn started his presentation, and he did a little test. He took his refractometer and he cut it and juiced it and then had people look. "Can you look? And you want to have it, yes, don't aim it at the light. Aim it straight and the light will catch it. What do you see?" 9. Okay. That's what I saw too. For tomatoes, there's the bigger tomatoes are not as sweet as the little tomatoes. The cherry tomatoes and the sun-drop golden tomatoes tend to be sweeter, and the bigger tomatoes, according to Tom's chart, tomatoes are considered excellent at 12. But that's the bigger tomatoes. The smaller tomatoes, excellent is higher than that. And so Lynn had gone to the grocery store, and he had purchased the best tomatoes he could get at the grocery store. And there were some pretty expensive tomatoes, and they were at 5. And then he got another one, and they were at also at 5. So then we used the Bergdorf semi-ripe tomatoes, and they were at 8, and then the cherries were at 10, and this cherry is 9. So this is, and then he had a little tiny orange one that he had got at the grocery store. It wasn't a Sun Gold drop, but it was kind of oblong. And it was 10. And I'm kind of embarrassed here because I'd heard Tom's story, and Tom's was more impressive than mine. But I'm going to tell my story, and he can say, well, mine better than yours. But when they were going doing the demonstration, they were getting to these numbers that were higher, and they're saying, oh, that sounds almost as good as the farmer's market, and they were getting pretty excited about it. And my orange ones were at 17, and Tom tells the story that his were at 22, which is phenomenal. It's that you're almost eating candy. I also had some honeydew, and honeydew, let's see what honeydew is.
How did you get the salt on these cherry tomatoes?
I'll tell you. That's an excellent point, and I will tell you. Honeydew is considered excellent at 14, and mine were 17. And my honeydew this summer were the best honeydew that I've ever eaten in my entire life. They were just very, very wonderful. Okay, your question about how to apply salt in the garden. Excellent question, and I'll try to answer it and still get back to my point. I'm not very good at that, so help me out. The best way, salt, when you use sea salt, the difference between medicine and poison is often not very much. So it is highly recommended to get a soil analysis, find out if you are high in sodium or low in sodium, and if you're high in sodium, you don't want to use sea salt or any kind of salt. But if your sodium level is below 1.5 CEC, which is, if you've been to Whitmer's class, he talks about cation exchange capacity. If you have less than 1.5, then you can add sodium until you get the right percentage. And in this presentation, I'm not prepared to teach you how to do it. I can do it, but I'm not prepared to teach you because it takes quite a bit of background. But if you want to figure out how much sodium your soil can handle, and then, in my case, I put on 1 pound of powdered sea salt. Let's see if I brought Tom's sea salt. I was going to bring Tom's sea salt, but I don't know that I have it. This is called Oceans 92. This is Tom's brand. There's something called C90, which is the same material.
It is C90. We're buying C90 in the industry.
Yes. And this has 92 elements from the ocean. And in my case, I applied 1 pound, this much, per 1,000 square feet. And there was a number of other elements that were in that I needed to apply to the garden, and I put them in a bucket and I stirred them all up together, and then I spread it carefully throughout each 1,000 square feet of my garden. I don't know how big your garden is, but you would do it according to if you have more than 1,000 square feet, you would multiply that times however much more than 1,000 square feet. If you have less than 1,000 square feet, you would multiply that by a percentage of, like if you have 350 square feet, you would multiply 0.35 times that number to get your percentage. And then later, I used, in Lynn's program, It calls for a soil drench, so you add certain nutrients once a month to the and flush the water around each plant, either in a hose or bucket or whatever. And so that also, for my, you have to follow the recommendation of your soil analysis, but you add that in with that soil drench, and then I...
You put the solids on in the spring, and then later you come with the drench?
And the drench is water once a month. And the drench is dissolved salt, where the first one is
and the
powder.
The
Pardon?
The drench is 1 to 10, as you were saying.
The drench is 1 ounce in 2.5 gallons of water, or whatever your when I was it was 1 ounce per 1,000 square feet, and then then I also did a foliar application. I foliar fed my plants once a week, and I put 1 ounce in the 1 gallon. The 1 gallon would cover the whole 1,000 feet. I actually do it 2 or 3 times to cover the thing. So yes. So does that answer your question? Okay. Where was I? Tom? Melons. Okay. The honeydews were absolutely amazing. How much of what of the flavor was due to the sea salt, I am not sure because I was following a complete program, but I am pretty sure that the sea salt was a major thing. I grew, this summer I had a whole spectrum of things, and in my garden, with very few exceptions, there were a couple of exceptions, but in my garden I was either, the lowest things I had were excellent, and up. And I never had as much good tasting food in my life. And the corn is here, sweet corn. Where's corn? It may not be on here, but it's 24. And mine was 29. Yes, sir. That was his question. You apply it when you fertilize before you plant. At least that's how I did it. It is water soluble, so if you put it on right when you plant your plants, and then the water will take it down. Or you can do it beforehand when you do your general fertilization.
Did you notice a drop in
the infestation? There was a drop, but I cannot quantify it. Yes, there was a hand, but I don't know if it was to me or to him. Did you raise your hand, young lady? I guess not. Okay. That's an excellent question. When there's several kinds of sea salt in the store, one is called Himalayan Pink. One is called Redmond's Real Salt. And there is undoubtedly other kinds. And then there is sea salt that is collected from the ocean. And this is one of them. This is collected from the ocean. Himalayan Pink, as you can figure out from your geography, was not collected from the ocean because the Himalayas go up to 30,000 feet. And so that somewhere in those mountains, there's a deposit of, from the flood or before, there, the mountains were at the bottom of the ocean and now they're at the top. When all the elements come down, in the rivers and lakes and all the tributaries that end up in the ocean, and the sea goes, the things settle out, and the stuff that is not in perfect suspension in God's proposed solution goes to the bottom. And that is what you're getting when you get the mined substance, the mined sea salt from the Himalayas or from Utah or from wherever it's mined. That is what's settled out. So you're not getting the ideal, perfect solution. It's undoubtedly good salt, but it's not as good as the stuff that is collected from ponds where they have at the ocean, the water will come up and it'll make a pond and it'll evaporate out and then they collect them. That's what this is.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.